And if it feels like everything is moving so fast right now, just keep in mind that we are still rotating at the same speed, about 1,000 miles an hour, and we are also rotating around the sun at around 67,000 miles an hour. No change there either. I bring this up because that bigger picture, that broader context, is what's most important to our next guest, Andreean, who, along with her late husband, astronomer and cosmologist Carl Sagan, created Cosmos. It was a TV series in 1980, brought back in 2014, and again next week for season 3 on National Geographic. There's also a new book by Andreean called Cosmos: Possible Worlds. Andreean is also on the board of Cornell's Carl Sagan Institute, and she joins us now. Andreean, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
So good to be with you and your listeners.
Well, and I have a lot to ask you about, but I want to start with what you start with in the book, which is the story of your late husband, Carl Sagan, as a 5-year-old attending the World's Fair, which was opened by Albert Einstein, who said, quote, "If science, like art, is to perform its mission truly and fully, its achievements must enter not only superficially, but with their inner meaning into the consciousness of the people." You say that has always been your dream when it comes to Cosmos and your life's work. How so?
Well, we live in a civilization that's entirely dependent on science and high technology. But so many of us have been effectively excluded from the insights and the methodology of science. And I think as we face one of the most daunting challenges that our species has ever had to deal with, climate change, it's more important than ever for us to begin taking the insights of science to heart. Not to compartmentalize science and think of it as 40 minutes of agony or boredom a couple of times a week or something for that rare television special, but instead to see science as a way not only of looking at absolutely everything, but also as a soaring uplift spiritually. And finally, science and the method of science is the great baloney detection machine. It's a way for every citizen to be an informed decision maker and to know, most of all, when we are being lied to. As a species, we are terrible liars. We lie to each other. We lie to ourselves. And our leaders, most especially of late, lie to us chronically. And the only way that we can wrest back the future from disaster is for each of us to be able to see clearly what we have to do and to act.
How did science get put, for so many, into that category of something that is boring, that you don't want to pay attention to, but maybe you have to sometimes?
That is such a deep question, Jeremy. I think one of the reasons that science has been so compartmentalized is because it's been viewed as a threat to our other belief systems. And it's also so empowering. That's what Einstein was talking about, giving the gifts, the revelations of science to everyone. And it's a tragedy, really, that I hope we can correct now.
One of the things that you do in this book is you talk about a lot of scientists from the past that probably most Americans have never heard of, and talk about the contributions that they have made. For example, a Russian botanist, Nikolai Ivanovich Vavilov, who collected over 250,000 varieties of seeds. Just tell me a little bit about him and why this was so important and what happened to him.
Well, this is a story that I've longed to tell for more than 2 decades. Vavilov was a pioneering geneticist, and he was a world-famous figure because he was a completely intrepid explorer of 5 continents. As soon as the revolution broke out in Russia, he rushed back because he had the same dream that I have, and that is he wanted to do everything he could to turn as many people into scientists. And so he was responsible for founding some 400 scientific institutions across the Soviet Union. Among his thousands of protégés was a man named Lysenko who never did the science, but rose to Stalin's favor and whispered in his ear that he could give Stalin a winter wheat crop by soaking the seeds of the wheat in ice water. He was a Lamarckian. He was someone who believed that inherited traits could be acquired. He was not a Darwinian. He kept whispering in Stalin's ear that Vavilov must be destroyed. And it's one of my favorite chapters in the book, one of my favorite episodes in the series, because we were able to enlist the talents of Viggo Mortensen to play Vavilov. Anyway, he stood up publicly and said words to the effect, "You can take me to the stake, you can set me on fire, but you can't make me lie about science." Hmm. And because of his courage, he was tortured and starved to death. But he had a dozen colleagues at his institute who refused to give in. And throughout the most horrendous siege probably in the history of the world, they were able to hold out to protect this precious collection of seeds. They ended up starving to death rather than consuming the collection. They did it because they believed that someday the world would be sane again after the war. And so they died to protect the future. And I keep thinking, if only we cared about our future as much as they did.
You know, there are so many instances of that in our history and in this book in particular, of people who really did have to think about something that they would never get to actually experience. They had to put their life's work into something that wouldn't happen for maybe generations afterward.
Exactly. And that's what we need. We do not have a system of human social organization that thinks beyond the next balance sheet or the next election. But we need to think, as some of our Native American ancestors did, in terms of seven generations, in terms of our impact on the long future. Science is thinking in the time scale of 13.8 billion years, the history of cosmic evolution. The legacy of life on Earth is 4 billion years old. We hold that legacy in our hands. We are the links in the chain this minute. And if you are alive now, then you are descended from generations of people who had their backs to the wall and somehow managed to rise to their challenges and to endure. Every one of us has that legacy.
You know, over the course of many generations, you're going to run into some bad people. And in many cases, these scientists did, whether it's Stalin or Hitler, who made their jobs very difficult, made it very difficult for them to do research, especially when the leaders didn't want to hear what the scientists had to say.
Well, now our leader is making life difficult for scientists who want to say what needs to be said. But for them, they weren't just giving up a good job. They were giving up their lives. And I find that so amazing. And the most wondrous thing about all of these people is not one of them was willing to hurt anyone else in order to see their goals reached. Yes, science has known sin. Scientists have given horrendous tools to leaders. But the fact is that every one of these individuals was completely nonviolent and yet willing to stand up when it was needed.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed about Cosmos, the TV show, and then now this this book, is that you make the connection between outer space and inside of our own bodies. For example, I think that there's a shot in the last season of Cosmos where you're zooming in on like a supernova or something like that in space, and then it turns into somebody's eye.
Right.
Tell me about that, the connection that you have made between our bodies, our DNA, and then everything out there in the universe and the stars.
Well, that very true connection was made before me by Carl Sagan and others, that we are star stuff, that every fiber in your hair, your skin, your bones is made up of atoms that were essentially cooked in the fiery hearts of distant stars. So to say the cosmos is within you is not poetry. It's not hyperbole. It's just hard scientific fact. And so, of course, because we come of age in a cosmic quarantine, you know, nothing of ours was ever sent into space until 1957. So naturally, we think of this artificial separation between us and the cosmos. But it's inside us and it's everywhere around us.
Given some of the things you talk about in this book, like trees giving off warnings to other trees,
or yes.
Bees, you know, dancing to send a message to the other bees, what is your relationship with spirituality? Do you look at all of these incredible coincidences and say it's just science, that there's no rhyme or reason behind it? Or what do you think?
Well, you know, what Carl Sagan taught me and so many others was that we need equal measures of rigorous skepticism and wonder, not one ever at the expense of the other. You asked a deep question earlier about why is science taught in such a way as to alienate so many people from it. I see us as a story-driven species. And for me, to put something into the book or the series, any story has to work on many different levels. It has to be a way into what is generally thought of as a complex idea, so that the thought steps that are necessary to get to ownership of that idea are part of the story. And so, you know, to me, if I had my wish, every child in pre-K would be taken with their guardians or parents and teachers out somewhere to see the stars. And they, instead of, you know, being told, you know, how important it is for them to sit still and be quiet and all those things, I would be so wonderful if we would induct them into the generations of searchers. Our current understanding of the universe is the product of 40,000 generations of humans, most of whom we will never know who they were or anything about them. But we are here because of their genius and their struggles. And so to me, as a non-scientist who was alienated in school, who was not a good science student, for me, you know, to have entered this world has been the greatest spiritual experience of my life, because instead of feeling stupid or excluded, I feel part of this great tradition of ours of trying to figure out how things are put together and how they work.
You have a great quote in this book. You say, if we could sail the cosmic ocean as skillfully as our ancestors navigated the Pacific, I know what I'd do. I wouldn't head for any particular world, but to an empty place 50 billion miles from the sun. First of all, why? And secondly, do you think that in your lifetime, we will make contact with some sort of alien species?
Wow, two great questions. Well, the first one is that's where I would put my dream cosmic telescope. We have all of the technical and physical know-how to do this today. If you were to place a cosmic telescope at that point and look back towards the sun and use the sun as your lens, now I know it sounds counterintuitive. How can you use something that's solid as a lens? But because we know that gravity bends light, somewhere on the other side of that sun is the focal point where the picture comes into focus. We could aim our cosmic telescope at virtually any place to see even the surfaces of other worlds at phenomenal distances. We could even look back in time. And if another civilization was to place their cosmic telescope at around that distance from their star, they could look back to Earth and resolve and see those Polynesian ancestors who explored the Pacific, 20 million square miles of sea without a single nail. And so that's where I'd place my cosmic telescope. And then the other question you asked me, I'm so sorry, can you repeat it?
Do you think that you'll experience a time when we find aliens?
I don't. You know, Carl taught me, and it's one of a zillion reasons that I revere his memory and love him so deeply, is that Carl taught me that such things are not things that you can predict or think about. You know, in other words, you can't answer with your gut whether or not we'll make contact in my lifetime. You can hope, and I do hope that. But the fact that this might be a thrill for my descendants makes me just as happy. And it's counterintuitive to me that we are the only intelligent species, or we are one of very few intelligent species on Earth, and the only one in the cosmos. That just doesn't make sense to me, because the more we know about the evolution of life, how life got started, which is another story we tell, the more it seems that the cosmos makes galaxies, stars, stars make worlds. And I think likely in many instances, or more than one, worlds make life.
There are so many aha moments in this book, and I'm sure that there will be in the TV show as well. What is the one that for you is the most incredible?
Well, I think I've already actually touched upon that, which is that life is so tenacious, that it's such an ancient continuity that I can never get over that. One of the discovery I made in terms of, and I just mean in terms personally, not generally, the discovery I made during the writing of the series with Brandon Braga, I would like to add, the thing that really astonished us the most was actually the degree of honeybee democracy. And this was, of course, the result of picking the brains of eminent scientists in that field. The way in which bees arrive at consensus in selecting their next hive is a source of astonishment to me. Mm-hmm. I had grown up in my ignorance thinking that it was a monarchy, that the queen bee was calling the shots, but it's nothing of the sort. They have conventions in which they make their argument. And the amazing thing is that there are skeptical bees that go to the hive that, you know, each bee is arguing on behalf of, and they check it out. And there can't be any hyperbole, exaggeration, or anything like that, because the survival of those bees depends upon the accuracy of each bee's argument for its particular location for a hive. I found that so exciting because it confirmed my belief that skepticism is a survival mechanism that we all need. And, you know, it breaks my heart to hear people talking about whether or not the Earth is round when all this information is at our fingertips. All of us have more access to information than anyone in any generation before us. But we need to have that kit that gives us a sense of discrimination in terms of what's real and what's a fantasy.
Andrian, how does it feel to do this work now without your late husband, Carl Sagan, who died in 1996 at the age of 62?
It's very hard to do anything without Carl, because for 20 years we did everything together. And, you know, the beauty of life keeps me afloat. I am so lucky to have our family, our children, and two granddaughters, and so many good friends. And so, you know, I miss Carl terribly, but I feel like it's such an honor to keep the flame burning and to carry on the work we did together, because I believe in it with all my heart.
That is Anne Drian, who is the author of Cosmos Possible Worlds. She's also executive producer of the series, which premieres on National Geographic next week. Andrian, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Jeremy, I'm so happy I did. I really love this conversation.